Warning, The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Is the Savage Nation, and let me tell you something. You know, I do a lot of shows, years and years of shows, thousands of shows. Some of them are great, some of them are good, none of them are bad. Today's show is going to be remembered. You're going to remember this show for years to come. We are going to talk about the financial meltdown, which I covered at length in my book, Trickle Up Poverty, about Wall Street and some of the characters involved in orchestrating the downfall and how they profited and how none of them went to jail. We all know about that, and that led to the election of this unknown politician from Chicago named Barack Obama. We understand that. Many of us who listen to the show regularly believe that that scenario is absolutely true. What you don't know, you're going to learn today. Last night, after the show, normal stuff, dinner with family, very nice. Turn on the TV, and I watch a show on HBO, Too Big to Fail. And I was captivated by it for a number of reasons. One, because it was one of the greatest propaganda pieces ever put out by HBO, known very well for its left-wing fanaticism. So you have actors in it such as Ed Asner playing Warren Buffett. Ed Asner, I don't have to tell you, is one of the biggest asses in the history of the world. Well-known, fanatic, psychotic leftist. And he plays Warren Buffett as a grandfatherly man who saves the universe. But he does a fabulous job as an actor. Now, here's the whole point. I've told you before is I love movies. It's just that I'm very sensitive to their bias, and I can read through it, and I can still enjoy it while saying, oh, that's a bunch of you-know-what, okay? So I watched the movie, and you've got great actor James Woods, the only conservative that I know of in the film. He plays the only villain in it, Dick Fuld, in the movie. Dick Fuld, you may remember, and we're going to talk more about him if I can remember where to find it, is the man who busted out, or shall we say permitted to be busted out, one of the great American companies, the Lehman Brothers. Here's a company that was 140 some odd years old. Dick Fuld let it go down, but he didn't lose a dime. In fact, what was missing from this HBO movie, Too Big to Fail, was virtually everything. I truly believe, and I could never prove it. In fact, let me just put it as a question, okay? I'll put it as a question. Here's the question. Did Hank Paulson pay the director to make this movie? Remember, they made a fortune, these people who busted out America and brought us Barack Obama and the rest of what we're living through. And by the way, today's economic collapse today, the collapse of the Dow Jones by 280 points is today's news story. Now, I was going to do this show anyway, irrespective of even if the stock market went up 280 points. But data is plunging. The market is collapsing. We're obsessed with Representative Anthony Weiner's wiener, where he says it might be his, it might not be his. He doesn't know if it is. He doesn't can't be sure if it was his shorts. It's crazy. If it was a Republican, he'd already be in jail. But because he's a lib, okay, they protect him. And that gets us right back to the movie. Cast of the movie, Too Big to Fail. Well-known fanatic leftist. Billy Crudup plays Timothy Geithner. I don't have to tell you who Timothy Geithner is. He's now the Treasury Secretary. He was the chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank during the crash. Now they moved him up to be their point man inside the Treasury Department. He's doing exactly what they want him to do once again. And again, the movie is worth watching if you're really interested in what led up to the economic collapse. However, I wouldn't say take it with a grain of salt. I would say take it with a copy of Trickle Up Poverty and read one chapter in that book only, which is the Wall Street, you know, the meltdown on Wall Street. You've got Paul Giamatti playing Ben Bernanke. He literally channeled the bearded one. He channeled the bearded one. And, of course, he pretends to be he portrays Ben Bernanke as a voice of reason and calm. When experts in the field of finance tell us that Ben Bernanke is A, a fool, an academic fool who doesn't understand the first thing about the real world, and number two, by artificially controlling and keeping interest rates at near zero to this day, he's actually causing a disaster in our economy. It's why the economy is stalled. It's because of Ben Bernanke's insane policies of keeping interest rates at near zero. We understand he's trying to control inflation. He doesn't want an inflationary trend to occur. But what he's doing instead is destroying the economy, according to experts, and we're going to talk about that. And one of the reasons the stock market has gone down today, I believe, is because the head of the Federal Reserve, Ben Bernanke, is merely a professor who lives in Ivory Tower. He may know a lot about the history of the Great Depression, which was his area of expertise in college, but I don't think he knows very much about the man on Main Street. To date, not one major figure from the Wall Street crisis of 2008 has been investigated, arrested, or had their assets seized. Please remember that Bernie Madoff, although a con artist, was not a major player in the disaster. Let me repeat that. The Treasury Secretary, as played by, who played him? Henry Paulson, William Hurt. Henry Paulson, we are not accusing him of any crime, but he was the Treasury Secretary, and he violated the law. All over the map, he broke every law. No, he broke many laws. Let's start with that. Let's not make an extravagant statement. The laws that he violated were astonishing. Then you have Geithner himself. The laws that he allegedly violated, not only according to this movie Too Big to Fail, which is a liberal movie, but according to people who really know what went on, again, these are actionable offenses. Let's go down the list. I mentioned some names you may not know. John Mack, never heard of him, right? Jamie Dimon, vaguely you know one of him. I think Morgan Stanley, played by Bill Pullman. Some of the other characters, Warren Buffett, I said, played by Edward Asner. Barney Frank
is in the audience, played by Dan Hedaya. And they do a very good job on Barney, but they don't actually get his voice. But Barney should be in jail, according to many people, because it was Barney with Franny who made the banks give loans to people that couldn't qualify. So many people believe Barney actually should be in prison for the things that he did, irrespective of the fact that he's a very big liberal, big mouth, and scares everybody with his big, big yap. And the fact is he actually broke the law in many, many ways, and Barney should be in prison, according to many people.
Not one major figure from their Wall Street crisis has been investigated, arrested. How about the man who was supposed to guard the hen house? George Bush's handpicked stooge, Christopher Cox, then head of the SEC. His job was to make sure what happened didn't happen. His job was to stop the actions of Wall Street. Instead, he looked the other way and he was complicit in it. Why was he never investigated? Why is he enjoying life as a lawyer in Southern California today? People are asking these questions, and there's no satisfactory answer other than we're living in a literally worse than a banana republic. Worse than a banana republic, because there is no social justice in this country. Now, I am using a loaded phrase of social justice because I want to turn it back on the leftists who misuse it. We all want real social justice, but I have discovered, and as you will discover by listening to today's show very carefully, the left-wing zillionaires use the thugs in the street, such as those in Acorn, such as those in the other groups that I'm going to mention, specifically to guard and protect their own interests and to attack their competition and business. This you may not know. Real social justice would see the indictment, the investigation, the indictment, and the trial of the individuals who gave us the financial meltdown. That's real social justice. But as I explained in the Nightmare on Wall Street chapter of my book, Trickle Up Poverty, both Democrats and Republicans laid the groundwork for this financial disaster. You see, Bill Clinton signed the law which eliminated the Glass-Steagall Act, which had separated traditional banks from investment institutions. Republican Securities Exchange head Christopher Cox eliminated the uptick rule, which allowed for massive short selling. Clinton is enjoying an easy retirement in Rockland County, New York, around the world in a lecture circuit. Christopher Cox has a cushy job in a law firm in Orange County where he's still allowed to handle financial matters. In fact, his expertise is, of course, banking and the financial world. Now, why is it that other major figures who are responsible for our economic debacle, such as Herbert and Marion Sandler, do those names ring a bell? You're going to hear a lot more about Herbert and Marion Sandler. We all heard about Bernie Madoff. We all heard about all of those people. We know that a big ticket, actually a big ticket arrest was made on Wall Street, and a large, heavyset man of Indian extraction was recently indicted and sent to jail, but he was a minnow in a sea of whales. There are those who argue there should be a major investigation of Herbert and Marion Sandler, and yet no one's ever heard of them. Oh, they were once put on Saturday Night Live, and they were ridiculed, but what you don't know about them, you're going to learn about today from an expert on them, Matthew Vadum, who has written a book, and the chapter is called Acorn's Favorite Loan Sharks, from his new book, Subversion, Inc., How Obama's Red Shirts Are Still Terrorizing and Ripping Off American Taxpayers. But I'm getting ahead of myself because I'm so excited. I've been up all day from early in the morning. I can't stop thinking about this. I'm obsessed with the topic because I've never seen such a massive criminal act conducted by so many people, none of whom have been indicted, arrested, or sent to prison. I'll be right back.
Savage.
We can all argue about how we got here. We're all responsible. It's a catastrophic mess.
The risk managers lost control.
Goldman and Morgan Stanley are going down now.
The nightmare scenario is already here. We're in it.
You can't just hand the banks piles of cash.
And what do I say when they ask me why it wasn't regulated?
Main Street wants Wall Street to pay.
35,000 jobs just disappeared in this city.
That'll start stacking sandbags. I just lost $90 million. Personally.
Okay, so we're talking about an HBO movie, Too Big to Fail. It is sort of a greeting card from those who did it to us, telling us that they were really heroes. The only villainous character, and even a mild villain, by the way, is Dick Fuld, played by James Woods. And Dick Fuld, as played by James Woods is a known conservative. He played the only villain. Everyone else was a hero. Everybody else, as portrayed in this movie, whether it be William Hurt playing Hank Paulson or Paul Giamatti playing Ben Bernanke, or Billy Crudup playing Timothy Geithner, or Ed Asner playing Warren Buffett, portrays a hero who saved us from the next depression. I don't believe it. I actually believe that we're going into another depression, specifically because those who caused the last one are still there. And if they're not in active power, they're behind the scenes, still controlling the scene, using puppets like Geithner to do their bidding, and Bernanke to do their bidding. Nothing has changed. In fact, the bonuses are still the same. The salaries are still the same. The same characters are still there. And there's been no investigation or indictment of those who did it to us. Now, if I were alone in this, you could say that I'm wrong. That's number one. But it's funny how both left and right agree with me on this. That's number one. But before we go down this road to any greater extent, and I'm going to cover this in such detail today, you're not going to believe it. You're going to hear things you've never heard or read before. I can guarantee it. I may not even take a single call. Call if you want. But I'm telling you, you're going to learn things you never knew about today, about the economic collapse. And remember, 280 points down today. Hope it goes up tomorrow. But when you have an economy being manipulated like this by short sellers, and you have it manipulated by a Bernanke who artificially keeps interest rates at near zero, you have a recipe for a real Great Depression. We're also going to talk about some loan sharks who busted out a bank, made $2.5 billion on their own, sold it to another bank, and then ran off with the money and funded, you ready for this? Acorn. They funded the group Acorn, MoveOn.org, Media Matters, ProPublica. They've given them tens of millions of dollars. They're the single largest donor to the ACLU with, in my opinion, their ill-gotten gains, and you never heard of them. Why would these billionaires, Herbert and Marion Sandler, not be known? And why would Herbert and Marion Sandler spend all this money, assuming they're so rich, which obviously they are, they sold their bank, which was filled with toxic mortgages, to another bank just before the collapse. They sold it for $25 billion, even though the bank was loaded with toxic mortgages. The bank they sold it to nearly went bankrupt because, obviously, there was nothing that they bought, basically a pig in the poke, a dying pig, and they thought it was a healthy pig. The fact of the matter is, what did they do with their money? Did they fund conservative causes? No, all their causes are extreme leftist groups like Acorn, MoveOn.org, Media Matters, and ProPublica. Now, why would billionaires support the left? This is a question that many of you have asked and shaken your head over and you don't know. You can come up with the comedic answer that liberalism is a mental disorder, but unfortunately in this case, when it comes to finances, that doesn't apply. These are some of the smartest people on earth. And let's not forget that some of these people we're talking about today are much smarter than us. They always were smarter in school. They knew how to learn faster. They went to better schools than you or I did. I'm very proud of my education, but I wasn't as smart as some of these financial guys, and I'll admit it. But before we go down this road, I want to remind you of something. I am not a poor man. I may sound like I'm a guy in the street with nothing, but I'm a wealthy man. I have worked for, how old am I? I've worked for over 55 years. I've worked since I'm 6 years old. I've saved a lot of my money. I invested a lot of my money wisely. I've never stolen a dime from anybody, ever. Every dime I've made, I've earned. Every single dime I've made, I've earned. Now, having said that, I still carry myself as though I am a worker. I began as a social worker. Then I was a teacher. I struggled as a grad student. I struggled for 20 years because I couldn't get the position I wanted because I was a white male. And the society said white males need not apply. And instead of going into the banking industry or the insurance industry because I knew nothing about it and I wasn't mathematically inclined and I was always a do-gooder, really, I wanted to do something good for the world. Somehow I stumbled into radio after many, many years. And here I am 16, 17 years later. And I'm not telling you that I'm doing badly. I don't want to deceive you. So I'm in a hybrid position in American society. I have outrage against thievery, to be very frank with you. To me, these guys are no different than the mafia. And in watching Too Big to Fail, I thought that I was watching The Godfather. But instead of going to the school of Little Italy, these guys went to Harvard, Princeton, and Yale. Instead of slurping spaghetti, they were eating oatmeal in the morning. Instead of downing a little a cappuccino or an espresso, they were drinking bottled water. But it was the same exact mentality of robbing and cheating and obfuscating their theft. And on top of it all, owning the government and owning the media, just as in The Godfather, to protect them from prosecution. But it gets even uglier.
Savage.
There is not a single senior official of the major non-prime players that caused this crisis that has been prosecuted. And, of course, therefore, none has been convicted. We know that there was massive illegality. That's what the FBI was talking about, that there was an epidemic of fraud. And the fraud overwhelmingly took the context of liar's loans.
That is Professor William Black on the Daily Ticker talking about none of the leaders of the collapse being prosecuted, and many of them are still in business. Again, look, let's start with the basics here. It's easy to say eat the rich, get the rich, kill the rich, you know, arrest the rich, hang the rich. Be careful, because most of you listening to this show would like to be rich. That's number one. If you scratch the surface of virtually any man in this country, you're not going to find a man who doesn't dream of success, whether it be through a book he writes, no matter how leftist he is. Take a look at the fatso. What's his name? The ugly fat man, the liar. I can't remember. The movie maker, the ugliest man in the history of filmmaking. Michael Moore, the ugliest man that God ever created. Here's a guy who sells total chicken feed to the left-wing fools who flock to the theaters to buy his lies, and he's a very rich man. He didn't exactly give his money away, did he? So if you scratch the surface, everybody wants to be rich. So before you start saying hang the rich, be careful. We're not saying hang the rich. We're talking about people we believe committed illegalities who have not yet been prosecuted because they own the government. They are the government. This is what I'm trying to tell you. Obama's not the government. Biden is not the government. They were put in power by these people and by others you never heard of. In the minds of those who have studied this, they are the front men. You know, like in England, there's the Queen. The Queen of England, who is a figurehead of the government. She's a figurehead, rather, of the nation. Excuse me. In that way, our president has long been merely a figurehead. It didn't start with Obama. However, I would say it's rather magnified under Obama. He's clearly just a figurehead. You can see this, how he's over his head in so many places. such as last week, the fool he made of himself in England while going on and on a speech while the Queen started to say play the music. So he's a figurehead. He's a puppet, in other words, of people who put him in power. Who are they? Well, you heard Soros over and over again. He isn't in this movie, by the way. How could it be that a man who ran one of the biggest hedge funds at the time, who profited delightfully from the economic collapse, is not even shown in the movie? How could it be that they find an actress to play Nancy Pelosi in a bit part, and they show Nancy Pelosi as a benign, wonderful human being who saves the world? How can they show a character playing Barney Frank,
who forced the government to give loans to unqualified, mainly minorities and illegal aliens, all of whom had houses because of social justice?
How come Barney Frank is not indicted for what he did? How come? Because they run the government. They are the government. It's not a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. It's a government, of the bankers, by the bankers, and for the bankers. Now, again, this feeds into a popular notion, which is that some bankers run the world. Well, guess what? The bankers run the world. In that money is the mother's milk of politics. Yes, the bankers run the world. Okay, let's start with reality. Yes, the bankers run the world. It doesn't mean, though, that all bankers are evil, corrupt, or criminals. But some are. There are criminals in all classes of the professions. There are great doctors. There are saintly doctors. And then there are shyster criminals. Sometimes the shyster criminal doctors go to jail. Most of the time they don't. But when have you last seen a banker get indicted and go to jail? Answer, never. Now, the reason that they don't go to jail, here's the interesting part. It's not so much that they run the government, although that's the big picture. It's that those who supposedly run the government don't touch them because they believe that nobody would be left to run the banks if they got rid of these corrupt ones who caused the collapse and are now profited to the tune of billions of dollars. Personally, nobody would be smart enough to run the banks. I don't believe that at all. I think that there are very smart people in the banking industry who are honest, who could do a very nice job of running the economy through running the banks, rather. So that's the background again. Let's look, for example, at another point. Dick Fuld, who was the CEO of Lehman Brothers during this collapse, is shown to be a man who was set up and thrown out the window by his competitors at Goldman Sachs in the form of the then Treasury Secretary. There's a lot of names here. The then Treasury Secretary. I have the name. I don't want to give it to you. I can easily give it to you. It's right here, and I'm searching for it. Paulson. Okay, Hank Paulson, as played by another actor whose name I forget, but he does a super job. William Hurt. Great job. Okay. So the fact is that Paulson worked for Goldman Sachs, as did Geithner. So you could say, well, Goldman Sachs is running the country. Hello, they're running the country. Is that necessarily bad? I don't know that it's necessarily bad. Not everything Goldman Sachs does should be seen as bad or evil or manipulative or crafty. They're very smart people. And many of the things they do have benefited you. And I have to go back to you. There are many people listening to this show who, during the housing bubble, made money. You bought condos for a low amount. You put in stainless steel appliances. You put in some tile, and you sold it for 20% more in a very short period of time. So in essence, you were flipping houses. If you were flipping houses, you were benefiting from the housing bubble that was created by Goldman Sachs. So you can't now blame them as the villains, nor can you blame them because you can't unload your final house. In other words, maybe you did 10 such flips, and you finally got to the point where you owned a $3 million property, and you were going to flip it for $6 million. And all of a sudden, the market fell out from under you, and you broke. Don't blame Goldman Sachs. It's just that you didn't get out early enough. So you got to see the whole picture here. And there's another thing I got to say along the way about the Sandlers, Herb and Marion, because in the next hour we have an author on who's just written a book about them that you will not believe. You can't believe it. We have Matthew Vadum, V-A-D-U-M, on with his new book, Subversion, Inc., How Obama's Red Shirts Are Still Terrorizing and Ripping Off American Taxpayers. Now, remember, the Sandlers, Time Magazine included in its 25 people to blame for the financial crisis list. He claims they preyed on the poor for years and paid Acorn, which also preys on the poor, to help them. And this is something you must come to understand today. These people, the Sandlers, made a fortune by selling their bank, which was filled with toxic loans, okay? They personally allegedly made $2.5 billion or $2.2 billion, and then they gave tens of millions to the ACLU. I think that they're the single largest donor to the ACLU. They gave them $9 million. They've also given money to all of the left-wing groups that you cannot believe would be allowed in America. Groups such as Human Rights Watch, they gave $23 million. Human Rights Watch hobbles America's fight against Islamic fundamentalism. They gave the ACLU nearly $10 million. The Sandlers also helped underwrite the creation of the Center for American Progress, the liberal fanatic left think tank, according to its president, John Podesta, who I believe was involved in smearing me and having me banned in England. But this is not personal. This is very political. They also paid Acorn and several other organizations millions of dollars. Acorn now. Now, why would a billionaire fund Acorn? You say that doesn't make sense. It's counterintuitive. According to Matthew Vadum, he says the Sandlers paid Acorn and several other organizations millions of dollars to protect their own interests. You want to hear how? Acorn members told reporters that the Sandlers paid Acorn to go out and attack their primary competition, Wells Fargo. Marcel Reed added that protesters were paid to march in the streets to demand an end to Wells Fargo's supposed predatory lending practices. He goes on, and an Acorn insider said in an interview, Wells Fargo was the Sandlers' biggest competition in California for subprime mortgages. Quote, Acorn was deployed to put so much pressure on Wells Fargo that they would not be able to do the subprime loans, close quote. He then goes on, Vadum does, and he says many Acorn members participated in the actions against Wells Fargo, believing that they were part of a legitimate campaign against predatory lending. Here it comes now. Here's the punchline. In reality, it was just another protest for hire operation, the source said. Although the Sandlers have a low public profile, their activist grant making is often more generous than that of George Soros, the preeminent funder of left-wing activism in America. In 2004, they gave $13 million to political committees such as MoveOn.org. Now, I want to go on and tell you something that you may not understand. All these leftist billionaires who you can't understand why, you would think they'd naturally be conservatives. Why would they fund these groups that seem to stand in opposition to people with money? Because they're using them as street thugs. As thugs to protect their interests, to protect them from being investigated, to protest if they are investigated, to throw mud in the eyes of the American people and attack conservatives, to attack anyone on the right, to continue to hound people on the right, to continue to smear people on the right like me, and to try to make you think that the real enemy are people on the right rather than they themselves, who are actually the heart of darkness. Now, we're going back to the movie Too Big to Fail, which was on HBO last night. James Woods plays Dick Fuld. So let's go to Dick Fuld in a minute. Dick Fuld, as I told you before, was the main guy at Lehman Brothers, the CEO. And the company, which had been around for 145 years, I think, died under him. Did he lose a dime? Did Dick Fuld lose anything? 30,000 people, I think, lost their jobs. People lost their life savings. But did Dick Fuld lose anything? No, not that we know of. According to a former Lehman Associate General Counsel who was responsible for drafting parts of Lehman's SEC filings, Oliver Budd, he alleges that Fuld was paid $529.4 million, $529.4 million over a short period of time between 2000 and 2007, nearly $500 million. But he also cashed out $469 million in additional money through stock sales. Can you believe this? Just before the collapse. So the fact is that Fuld apparently did very well indeed. The stockholders lost money. You may have lost money. People's lives were destroyed. But he owns a lot of property. In fact, he owns an awful lot of property. In fact, he owns an awful lot of property. They have a five-bedroom home on 3.3 acres on exclusive Jupiter Island, Florida, for which they paid $13.75 million in 2004, which they reportedly tore down and rebuilt because it wasn't good enough for them. He subsequently said he transferred the property to his wife for about $100 just before the collapse. Now, Fuld's net worth, though, remains a bit of a mystery, according to William D. Cohan of CNN Money Fortune magazine. His actual net worth is something mysterious, and it's controversial. And I've given you some ideas. It seems to be very high, but the fact of the matter is, Fortune calculated that Dick Fuld sold $482 million worth of his Lehman stock between 2000 and 2007. So he was selling out his own company behind the scenes, according to Fortune. How come he has not been investigated? How is it possible? Now, he was brought before Congress, if you remember. In 2008, he appeared at a congressional hearing just after Lehman's collapse, and Fuld sparred with Rep. Henry Waxman, who released a chart showing that Fuld had made $484 million from 2000 to 2007. Under oath, Fuld denied he had made that amount, but he said he had received closer to $310 million during those years. Later in the hearing, Fuld conceded it might have been closer to $350 million, but he said it was not $484 million. What am I getting at here? I'm getting at a very important point. How come he did not lose any money, even though he was involved with the complete breakup and destruction of Lehman Brothers? How come that was not shown in Too Big to Fail? How come they end with James Woods drinking a 6,000 bottle of cognac? I think it's the $6,000 variety because I have had a bottle of that myself at one point. I don't actually like cognac. It's very different. Frankly, Hennessy from a corner liquor store is just good. If you want to tie one on, I mean, really, truly, you don't have to wait for the $6,000 cognac. Just go to get a bottle of Hennessy at the corner store, and you know what I mean? You'll be in the same place after about 4 ounces. So James Woods is not shown as Dick Fuld in exile, in his billion-dollar exile. He's shown as a ruined, destroyed man. There's another couple of elements of the movie, Too Big to Fail, that should be talked about. Toxic Assets Relief Program. Remember TARP? The movie ends with a bunch of script on the screen. Almost all the money that TARP lent to the banks has been paid back. How do we know that's true? Because what, the government tells us that? Because the banks told us the TARP was paid back? How about the interest on the TARP money? Because it was your money and it was illegal. In fact, the movie does a good job of showing that it was really a bailout of these very people who busted us out, but they were afraid to call it what it was, which was a bailout. So they came up with a new word called TARP, Toxic Assets Relief Program. But remember, the banks got the money at, what, 0.25 interest? Or zero interest? They paid no interest on the money? How come? Where's the interest they owe we the people? How come that's not investigated? And again, that was not shown in the movie. I'll be right back.
Savage.
It's the unofficial policy of the United States. It's never going to be put in writing because that would be deeply embarrassing. But the de facto policy right now is elite frauds go free if they're in banking because the whole sector is too fragile. And that is significantly insane. It will produce the next crisis. It'll make the next crisis come sooner, and it'll make the next crisis far, far worse.
That's Professor William Black from the Daily Ticker on financial crooks not being prosecuted, and that's what we're focusing on today because of two reasons. One, because of the HBO biopic Too Big to Fail, which I watched last night with fascination, and of course, because of today's stock market news, which ties directly into this. The fact of the matter is things were not really fixed. The patient was just patched up and sent home, and now the patient, it looks like, has cancer. The patient really didn't have a cold, meaning the economy. It was not just the cold, take two aspirin and call me. The patient really had cancer. And now we're facing the cancer of the economic system. And the doctor, unfortunately, is out to lunch. Or shall I say, there is no doctor in the house. Let me take a few calls because I'm going to stay on this for a while. It's an astounding story. It's not going away. It's only going to get bigger. I was fascinated by Too Big to Fail because it was so well done to the 90th percentile. Some of the script writing was comedic. I mean, the woman who plays Hank Paulson's wife was pathetic. You know, she was the hurt, caring wife at their home in Michigan, always waiting there for him. And he was so pained trying to save the world. And he was a Christian Scientist who doesn't take so much as a beer during the crisis, but he throws up with anxiety. And he's given sleeping pills by one of the other guys at the bank, but he throws them down the toilet. I mean, it was pathetic, the whole thing. The most laughable scenes were those of Ed Asner playing Warren Buffett, especially The one of the Warren Buffett character with his children in McDonald's. I mean, do you actually believe that the richest man in the world has no bodyguard? Do you actually believe that while every Hollywood slut has a bulletproof limousine and two thugs to put on an act, that the richest man in the world really plays that humble a life? I mean, come on, I don't believe any of this. And if you do, good luck to you, okay? Let's take your calls right now on the Savage Nation. Bill in New York, fire away. You're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. I agree with you about everything you've said, except for one thing. The second half of this economic collapse in 2008 was caused by the deregulation of derivatives.
Hold on for a minute. I don't claim to be an expert. I've studied it, but the guys who are in finance are smarter than I am in finance. I'm good at certain things and not good at other things. I know the uptick rule shouldn't have been eliminated under Bush, and I also know that the Glass-Steagall Act shouldn't have been eliminated under Clinton. Please explain what you mean by what you just said.
Okay, I can't explain it in 2 minutes, but I'll tell you how to get it. You could Wikipedia Brooks Lieborn, who was the Commodity Futures and Exchange Commission head at that time, who had the authority to regulate derivatives in 1998. This all occurred under Bill Clinton.
Can you tell me again what to search? What is it now?
Her name is Brooksley, Brooksley.
Yeah.
Her last name is Born, Born. Wikipedia,
yeah.
Her. Go down to derivatives, and you'll see a show called Frontline that explains the whole thing. Frontline,
oh.
One called The Warning.
So PBS did investigate the derivative scam?
Yes, they did.
Wow. Bill, stay on the line. I got to learn more about the credit default swaps.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
We can all argue about how we got here. We're all responsible. It's a catastrophic mess.
The risk managers lost control.
Goldman and Morgan Stanley are going down now.
The nightmare scenario is already here. We're in it.
You can't just hand the banks piles of cash.
And what do I say when they ask me why it wasn't regulated?
Main Street wants Wall Street to pay.
35,000 jobs just disappeared in this city.
I gotta start stacking sandbags. I just lost $90 million.
Personally.
We are on the Savage Nation, continuing our discussion of the movie last night on HBO, Too Big to Fail, which was dramatically interesting, captivating, but of course a greeting card that was probably written with money provided by some of the villains in the banking industry to the writer of the book who works for the New York Times, incidentally, the director, etc. Nevertheless, it's worth watching if you have HBO. But watch it with a very, very, very cautious, a great degree of caution, because most of it is fiction. We're now going to go and talk about some of the notes of Too Big to Fail, which exposes some of the villains behind the collapse of 2008. And if you're interested in the news, the market fell 280 points today because the patient is still dying. The patient was not really fixed by TARP and by the stimulus funds. The patient actually was just patched up and sent home, and the disease has now apparently spread. We all want the disease fixed. We want the economy fixed, and we want this done as quickly as possible. But we're not going to get it so long as, A, there's no justice. That means an investigation of the real players and an indictment of those who did commit crimes, and the return of assets that were taken from the American people. And I could start with one of them instead of speaking generically. The TARP fund, which is $750 or $800 million, I don't remember the number, approved by Bonnie Frank and Nancy Pelosi, TARP, remember? It was a bailout, Toxic Assets Relief Program. We have been told in this movie and elsewhere that all the money has been paid back by the banks. We don't know if that's true, number one, but even if it is, they did not pay back any interest on the money. So that's the number. Let's start with the interest on $700 million over that period of time. Let's demand that the banks give us the interest, okay, whatever the rate may be. Let's start with that. And then let's look at what the word TARP itself means, the acronym TARP, TARP, Toxic Assets Relief Program. Well, what do you mean by toxic assets? Well, that means mortgages that were backed by nothing. That means illegal aliens and others who were given mortgages, even though they couldn't qualify, because Bonnie Frank insisted that they get the mortgage in order to not sue the bank for racism and for discriminatory lending practices. They were forced to give loans to people who were unqualified, largely minorities, mainly minorities, rather, and illegal aliens. So when it all came down, who's responsible? Well, there's a lot of people responsible. You can start with Bonnie Frank. You can go to others in the banking industry who were named in the movie or not named, and including people such as those who are going to be discussed on the Savage Nation in this hour with an expert on the subject, the Sandlers. The Sandlers will be looked into in detail by Matthew Vadum, V-A-D-U-M, pardon me if I'm mispronouncing your name, Matthew, from his new book, Subversion, Inc., How Obama's Red Shirts Are Still Terrorizing and Ripping Off American Taxpayers. You're not going to believe what you hear about the Sandlers, Herb and Marion. It's astounding. Then, of course, there's Christopher Cox, the SEC chairman. Why was he never asked how he let this happen? So let's go back to one of my callers from the last hour, Bill in New York. You were making a point about derivatives before we took the break, and we looked up the woman you mentioned. It's fascinating, on Brooks Lee Born. Tell us about it.
Okay, Brooks Lee Born was the future Commodities and Exchange Commissioner. She was the head. She had the authority to regulate derivatives, and she saw the problem. She predicted the problem back in 1998. At that time, Bill Clinton was the president, and she reported directly to the president. Robert Rubin, who was then Treasury Secretary, who was plucked from Goldman Sachs by Bill Clinton,
right,
along with Larry Levitt, Timothy Geithner was aboard on that too.
Yes.
Also, the Larry
Goldman. Wasn't Geithner also from Goldman Sachs?
I'm not sure about that. You could look up his history very easily. I think he had.
But the long and short of it is, this woman, Brooks Lee Born, saw this coming. She tried to stop it. She tried to regulate it. And even though she was appointed by Clinton, she was blocked at every turn. I read that Born was concerned about swaps of financial instruments that are traded over the counter between banks. Can you tell us what a credit default swap is, Bill?
Okay. Michael, these are sophisticated instruments. I don't know a lot about them, but I just know that it's a side bet. These default swaps are side bets. If a company's going to tank, it's a bet that you have insurance if it tanks. So you win.
So in other words, the big boys were trading with fiduciary instruments that didn't exist prior to the age of the gangsters on Wall Street. And they were basically playing with worthless paper and trading worthless paper for other worthless paper and then taking real dollar profits from it in plain English. She tried to stop it, and she said that these default swaps, which were being used as over-the-counter trades between banks, insurance companies, and other funds, had no transparency at all whatsoever. And although she wanted to regulate it, it was opposed by Federal Reserve Chairman Alan Greenspan and by Treasury Secretaries Robert Rubin and Lawrence Summers. That's what I'm reading right now. So Alan Greenspan, whose wife works for MSNBC, by the way, is deeply enmeshed in all of this, and yet he's never been investigated.
Basically, yeah.
All right, thanks for the call. This keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Just remember this, the bigger the kindly smile, the bigger the kindly smile, the bigger the crime. And Balzac didn't say that, I said that. The larger the friendly smile, the bigger the crime. The more they talk about fly fishing and about the environment, the greener they are, the more green they make. 1-800-449-8255. The average person listening to this is probably not able to follow it. I'm telling you, you have to follow it. And I'm going to make it simple for you. Let's start from the top. Those who caused the financial crisis in 2008 and ushered in Barack Hussein Obama are basically still pulling the strings, and they're going to put Obama back in power in 2012 as witness the Republican field right now. Why do you think the Republican field is chaotic? Why do you think no front runner has appeared? Why do you think the Republican Party is acting like, oh, shucks, we don't know what to do? Because it's a scam. Don't you understand? I told this to you 1,000 times on the show if I told you once. This is one man's opinion. The way the game is played is it's 8 years Dems, then 8 years Repub, then 8 years Dems and 8 years Repub. We had 8 years of Clinton. Then we had 8 years of Bush. We only had so far a 2.5 or 3 years of whatever the number is of Obama's regime. And he can't leave yet because they need him for 8 years. It's the way the game is played. So they can continue to say, well, when we're back in power, we'll straighten it out. Then it goes on and on and on. Okay, and that's where the Tea Parties arose. They're actually the American heroes. You have to understand that hundreds of millions of dollars being spent by Soros and others to smear the Tea Parties. Whenever you hear a commentator casting aspersions on Tea Parties, that's because they're bought and sold like prostitutes in Eastern Europe right now. Make no mistake about it. Half the commentators are owned or paid for by the Sandlers or by Soros or by one of the other front liberal groups, in my opinion. And they're cheaper than the cheapest whore on the cheapest street in your city. I don't care how pretty they may look. They're lower than the cheapest whore in your neighborhood. They're worse than the cheapest whore. It gets me sick to see them get away with it. They're bought and sold like a cheap whore in Budapest. And I'm sorry to be so graphic, but it's the only way you're going to listen to me. That's the only way you're going to listen to me. 1-800-449-8255. I told myself not to get excited because I could do more work and more important work by not getting excited, but I'm really worked up. I see this movie, Too Big to Fail, on HBO. And I enjoy it because I like art. Okay, it's moderately good art. And some of the actors are some really fine actors. Like, I've always loved James Woods. He plays the only villain in it. He plays Dick Fuld. But even the villainy of Dick Fuld is not really shown. And then Edward Asner, the biggest ass in the history of Hollywood left-wing actors, plays the hero in the form of grandfatherly Warren Buffett who saves the world. Then they bring up an unknown Linda Glick to play Nancy Pelosi. And Nancy Pelosi is portrayed as a little saint who says we'll fund the TARP program to save the world. You see, they make it look as though Nancy Pelosi and Barney Frank were against it in the beginning, but they did it. They did it because they had to save the world. In order to save the world from another depression, Nancy Pelosi, the most honest woman in the history of the world, along with Barney Frank, the most morally superior and honest man that has ever sat in a chair in Congress, they reluctantly go along with the TARP money, even though they're Democrats and liberals, because they do it knowing that they have to save the universe. And they do so reluctantly, knowing the little guy may not like it. Okay, so this is like a comic book. And, of course, you'd expect that from a writer for the New York Times who wrote the book. Nevertheless, I enjoyed the movie because it made me think all over again about the catastrophe on Wall Street, which I spent months studying and wrote about Nightmare on Wall Street and Trickle Up Poverty. Great chapter, great book. Reread it if you have the book. Buy the book and read the chapter if you don't have the book. And now we're going to move beyond that book to today. Because at at the bottom of the hour, at 34 minutes after the hour, I have an expert on about the Sandlers. He has a real knowledge of he calls them Acorn's favorite loan sharks. The Sandlers. They call them leftist loan sharks, whom Time magazine included in its 25 people to blame for the financial crisis. And he said they preyed on the poor for years and paid Acorn, which also preys on the poor to help them, he writes. It was the Sandlers World Savings Bank that was the first to offer an exotic mortgage product called the Option, ARM. And they pushed the mortgage, which offered several ways to backload your loan and thereby reduce your early payments, with increasing zeal and misleading advertisements over the next 2 decades. Now, I want to pause right here, because I actually think the adjustable rate mortgage was a good thing. See, you wouldn't expect me to say that. But I happen to be the fairest-minded person in the history of the American media, also probably the most educated and the most knowledgeable. When it comes to finance, I don't know as much as I would like to know, or else I would have been in finance. I never was good at finance. Numbers always bored me. I never went into anything for the money. But as I got older, I found out that, guess what? You better go into things for the money or you won't have any. I'll be right back.
Savage.
People took a mortgage in the last 3 years. 7 million of them took teaser rates or took piggyback rates. Mm-hmm. They will lose their homes. This is crazy.
Yes.
I am sorry to be upset about it, but you have to understand what they're saying to me off the record before I come in here every night and every day, and what I hear from these blowhard managers who act like, call someone for heaven's sake. Go call someone. I worked at fixed income at Goldman Sachs. This is not the time to be complacent.
All right.
I mean, darn, sometimes I wish I didn't know anybody.
This is Cramer, Jim Cramer, going nuts over the near stock market collapse on CNBC in 2008. He also slammed Bernanke. Listen to clip 10. It's very important you hear this.
This is about Bernanke. He has to be on that call. Forget the investors. The investors are going to do, if Bernanke listens, Bernanke needs to open the discount window. That's how bad things are out there. Bernanke needs to focus on this. Alan Greenspan told everyone to take a teaser rate and then raise the rate 17 times. And Bernanke is being an academic. It is no time to be an academic. It is time to get on the Bear Stearns call. Listen, open the darn Fed window. He has no idea how bad it is out there. He has no idea. He has no idea.
No, he has no idea, but he's still there. Okay, Ben Bernanke is still there. Mr. Mild-mannered, oatmeal-eating Ben Bernanke, the quiet, peaceful man, is an academician who studied the Great Depression and walks around that with almost a cross to bear, where everything he does will almost guarantee us that we will have another Great Depression. Today, the market fell 280 points. Some are saying, because the fundamentals are bad. The fundamentals are bad. The planned layoffs are up. The private sector jobs are growing very slowly. Manufacturing is slowing. The administration is letting jobs being shipped to be shipped overseas. They're letting all manufacturing go overseas. They're not slamming the door on imports. They're not imposing tariffs, which would help the economy, not hurt it. And I, look, on and on and on. Don't assume that because I'm not on Wall Street, I don't have ideas about how to cure some of the disease. I could stop some of this disease if I had the power. Believe me, I could. And I wouldn't listen to half of these nitwits from Harvard or Yale, because although they may have degrees in the field, they are so inbred that they listen to their own music. All they do is hear their own music. And they all repeat each other's wisdom. And they all use the same concepts without thinking it through and looking at the real world. I live in the real world. I don't know how many academics in the Ivy Tower actually live in the real world. 1-800-449-8255. Let's take some of the calls on the Savage Nation. Rich, fire away from Maine. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, hi. I was just going to make two pithy points. They're not that smart. You've driven that, nailed that one home. You're upset because of this show, because you know it's been a hit piece to spin the actual facts of history. And whether it's AIG and Zurich Insurance, I don't know whether you got to dump it.
Yeah. Did you watch it? Did you see Too Big to Fail?
I couldn't. I'd be like you. I couldn't sit through it. And I wanted to make a point, though. Whether those two big insurance companies early on were keeping their workman's comp policies off the books, no certificate of insurance, and aggregate policies. So they, you know, keep
right, well, they,
off.
By the way, after letting Lehman die, they supported AIG with a bailout. Now, why would they support AIG? Why didn't they let it collapse? The answer was because everybody had money that was involved with AIG, and it would have brought the entire system down, as the argument of the movie Too Big to Fail. Is that true?
It's an inside click, and I tell people in a pithy point. I said they had a lawyer that trained lawyers to sue lawyers. They expanded to give loans to people that didn't qualify. And the
right.
Banks
it was the loans to people who didn't qualify that caused the bubble. That was the primary engine, and that was caused by Barney Frank and the other left-wing fanatics, and they didn't do it because they love poor people. Okay, as you're going to learn very shortly when I return.
Savage.
So, okay, we're talking about the HBO postcard last night called Too Big to Fail. Joining us right now is an author who really knows his business. And without any further abduction, Matthew Vadum. Matthew, welcome to the Savage Nation with your new book.
Thank you.
Matthew, this is amazing, coming on the heels of what the movie just came out, Too Big to Fail. Tell us not so much only about the Sandlers, who I know you know a lot about them, but Time magazine recently did an article on the 25 people to blame for the financial crisis, beginning with Angelo Mozzillo. You have anything to say about the big group here?
One of the big groups involved in this is Acorn. They weren't named in the 25 list, but Herb and Marion Sandler were definitely up there, the subprime mortgage hucksters you've been talking about today. And they definitely contributed to the subprime, to the mortgage bubble, which is now deflating and ruining people's lives across America.
Now, they sold World Savings to Wachovia, correct, for $25
right.
billion? Dollar?
Mm-hmm.
For $25 billion, and allegedly they pocketed $2.3 billion in 2006. But when you analyze the acronym TARP, Toxic Asset Release Program, which was a bailout, what are toxic assets if not bad mortgages, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Non-performing
so
mortgages.
Would you say it's fair to say the Sandlers sold toxic assets to Wachovia?
Yeah, I would.
Okay.
They sold high-risk mortgages from a lot of people who could not afford to pay for the houses that they purchased, because they bought them at the top of the market, and then the price bubble started to deflate. And the Sandlers went out of their way to make it easy for people who had no money to buy houses. And
all right, let's pause right there, because some people would argue that was a good thing. It got poor people into the housing market. The problem was it was built upon the false premise that prices would keep going up and they could refinance. That was the bad part, correct?
That's right. That's right. And a lot of people got caught up in that. It certainly didn't help that we had Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac serving as a dumping ground for all of these low-quality mortgages. So that, you know, they'd buy them, the banks would make the mortgages, they'd do the loan, and then Fannie and Freddie would buy them and aggregate them and sell them as mortgage-backed securities on the markets, providing a ready market for what essentially are, you know, is these are junk mortgages. So
Matthew, your book, is it out yet? Did it just come out, Subversion, Inc.?
Yeah, it just came out a few days ago. Subversion, Inc.
Okay, good. Well, this is very good for you and very good for the show, because this fits right in, Matthew. You open this chapter with this line: radical South American regimes and Hollywood actors have some fascinating company when it comes to supporting Acorn. And then you say, in 2007, toxic mortgage tycoons Herb and Marion Sandler gave $600,000 through their foundation to the Pew Charitable Trust to protect sharks from their human predators. It was an act of professional courtesy. I think that's very intriguing, but it's not funny. And the question that keeps wanting to be answered, which I think you answered for me, and I didn't know quite why billionaires would give money to radical leftist street thugs, such as those in Acorn, and such as those in these hit groups like the ACLU, why they give money to the Human Rights Watch for $23 million, which hobbles our fight against Islamic fundamentalism. None of it made sense till I realized that they did so in self-interest. And I'd like you to tell the audience what I mean by billionaires funding leftist groups in their own self-interest.
Well, right. Herb and Marion Sandler are part of George Soros's Democracy Alliance, which is a club of leftist billionaires that want to radically transform America. They want to turn America into France or worse. Mm-hmm. And the Sandlers gave $11 million to Acorn and its affiliates from 1999 through 2008, okay, through their tax-exempt charity, the Sandler Foundation. And according to my sources within Acorn, then Acorn went and protested their competition in California. Their competition at the time, while they were still in business, before they sold out to Wachovia, mm-hmm. was Wells Fargo. Okay, mm-hmm. that was their biggest competition in California at the time, and so they did marches and they did various actions. They called it Acorn. They call them actions. That's when you mm-hmm. storm a bank and you do a sit-in, or you go to a corporate CEO's home and you bang on his door and scare the living daylights out of his children, dump garbage mm-hmm. on the guy's lawn. That's an mm-hmm. action. Okay, it's mm-hmm. it's a euphemism, like a military term.
Yes.
And this is what these people did. So Acorn, having been paid to provide rent-a-mob services, provided
yes.
these services to Sandler's to the Sandler's company, to their SNL, and Acorn protested Wells Fargo and stirred up a lot of trouble for them. And Wells Fargo, ironically, is the bank that bought Wachovia after the junk mortgage portfolio that the Sandlers had acquired over the years began to deflate as defaults started to rise. And so mm-hmm. there was a forced sale, and Wachovia was purchased, as I said, irony or coincidence, you decide, it was purchased by Wells Fargo. So this met their radical left-wing, this was consistent with their radical left-wing ideology, and it gave them a business advantage.
So in other words, they were making believe that they were worried about the poor and the disequity in society. But in fact, in your analysis, they were funding groups like Acorn basically to destroy their competition.
Absolutely correct.
Astounding. I mean, I didn't know this, Matthew, until you sent me the piece from your new chapter. But when I see that through their charity, the Sandlers have given tens of millions to groups that seek to hobble America's fight against Islamic fundamentalism, such as Human Rights Watch, how does that compute on a dollar level? I mean, on a personal interest letter, why would the Sandlers want Human Rights Watch to stop our battle against Islamic fundamentalism?
Well, because they have the same beliefs as these radical new left nut bars, like Bill Ayers and so on. Bill Ayers thought the best way to change America was to blow up the Pentagon and statues and public buildings. These other new leftists thought that the best way was to go about it in a less violent fashion. And so mm-hmm. they started funding all these activist groups. And Acorn was born out of that in 1970. And, you know, these people just have a warped anti-American worldview, and they don't like America as...
Well, I hear that. I agree with that. But why would people like this want us to stop our fight against Islamic fundamentalism and the invasion of all of our institutions by sleeper cells? I don't understand that part of it. Is it just simply because they're part and parcel of that mentality, liberalism, the mental disorder?
Well, yeah, I think it's something that David Horowitz has touched upon, and that is that there's and Jamie Glazov have touched upon, that there is this alliance between the radical left and Islamic fundamentalists. And what they have in common, basically, is they both hate America and what America stands for. They don't like America's free institutions. They don't like that America provides constitutional protection for individual rights. And they don't, first and foremost, they don't like that America is a nation founded upon restrictions being placed on the powers of government. That really mm-hmm. bugs them, because these people are idealists, and I don't mean that in a way that I'm praising them. I mean that
yes.
they have this ideal where they think that the
government... Wait, Stalin was an idealist, and Hitler was an idealist as well. There's no question about it. Pol Pot was an idealist. I mean, idealism can go in many different directions.
Their ideals were bad, but they were
yes.
They're idealists, and they believe that
yes.
that government can remake man, that you can tinker with human nature, and they believe in the perfectibility of man, and this is a sick leftist idea that's been around a long time, you know, like Jean-Jacques Rousseau and the social contract and the French Revolution. That's what these people are all about. Now, I don't know when the Sandlers acquired these beliefs, because they're like in their 80s, around their 80s, so they're more likely part of the old left, but,
yes.
You know, they're leftists nonetheless.
Yes, they're leftover leftists who are very wealthy. Now, but Matthew, I want to look at the pages you sent me today from your new book, Subversion, Inc., and I want to keep it simple for the listener out there who may not know what we're talking about. I started today by talking about the HBO movie Too Big to Fail, which allegedly was about the crisis, the financial crisis, and how the world was saved by Hank Paulson. Did you happen to see it yet, Matthew?
No, I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard a lot about it.
Oh, you've got to watch it, because it ties right into your book. But they rewrote history, obviously. Ed Asner plays Warren Buffett in the most comedic fashion as the savior of the universe. Hank Paulson is seen as a great man, as opposed to the man from Goldman Sachs who engineered the crisis. Let's talk about Hank Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary. Do you have any opinion on his actions?
If they make a movie about Lynn Stewart, the terrorist lawyer, Ed Asner
yes.
should play her.
But what about Hank Paulson? Do you have any opinion about him?
Hank Paulson is goody-two-shoes, Goldman Sachs elitist, and thinks he knows what's best for America. And he helped force the TARP program through, and I think he has a really one-dimensional way of looking at problems, and he thinks that only government working with elite groups like Goldman Sachs can save the economy. And so, you know,
well, but he made $500 million. Allegedly, he made $500 million on his own. What about Chris Cox, the former head of the SEC? He was supposed to watch these people. How come he's gotten away without any investigation?
Yeah, no idea. No idea. No, I you know, Chris Cox, I don't really have. I haven't really thought a lot about him.
No, he's he's one of the silent partners in this. But remember, here's the important thing to remember for everybody listening. This all happened under George Bush. Let's not forget this, because this is not a Democrat-controlled problem. This is a joint problem of both parties, which is why I've been screaming about Democrat Republican for 15 years now. And, of course, many people are aware that we need a third party, but I don't want to go down that road. So in your new book on this, Acorn's Favorite Loan Sharks from Subversion, Inc., what else is in there that we should know about, Matthew?
There's lots of stuff in there, interesting stuff. Newt Gingrich calls Acorn fascist in terms of their tactics, and he actually ridicules Rudy Giuliani and Sarah Palin. He thought that they were wrong to mock community organizers at the September 2008 Republican convention because
that's Newt Gingrich.
Newt Gingrich said that. I interviewed him. So you won't see that anywhere else. It's in my book, Subversion, Inc. So he thought it would have been an opportunity, if they hadn't mocked Obama and community organizing, it would have been an opportunity to educate the public about what a serious, you know, what a threat the guy was to the country. And, yes. You know, there's a lot of this kind of stuff in there. There's also, I interviewed the arch-leftist, the anarchist communist Noam Chomsky.
And, oh, my God. Well, is he still living?
Yeah, he's in his 80s. He's slowing down. But
why is it that old leftists never die? They just lose their... why do they live so long? I don't understand this.
I guess if you enjoy your work, like, you know, destroying the United States, it keeps...
The only one who went the right way was Abby Hoffman. You know, he should have been a role model for all of them.
Well,
I'll be right back on the Savage Nation. Welcome back to the Savage Nation. We're talking about the financial crisis that not only was but is. The Dow tumbled 280 points today. It might recover tomorrow. No doubt there's some short selling by the same gangsters who got us in this position. They're able to manipulate the currency. They can manipulate the stock market. There are virtually no controls over any of these pirates. There were attempts to control them. For example, you may not know this, but in the beginning of Bush's administration, we had an SEC head, William Donaldson, who tried to boost regulation of mutual and hedge funds. But he was blocked by Bush's advisors at the White House, as well as other powerful Republicans, and he then quit because he couldn't do his job. Never forget that the meltdown happened under George Bush. George Bush, from the start, embraced the growing philosophy of deregulation, deregulation, deregulation. And that trickled down to federal oversight agencies, which in turn eased off on banks and mortgage brokers. The fact of the matter is, there have been previous banking scandals. Remember the SNL scandal? Remember the Enron scandal? People went to jail. Do you remember the Enron scandal? There are people who are still in jail. Do you remember the SNL crisis? People went to jail. They lost everything. But in this case, virtually nobody has gone to jail. Let's go back to our guest, Matthew Vadum. Matthew, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hey there.
Vadum. Sorry, Matthew. Your name is more difficult than mine. So in your book, Subversion, Inc., we're learning about a lot of the villains, and you're saying that Acorn's favorite loan sharks, in your estimation, are Herbert and Marion Sandler.
That's right.
Again, did they actually commit a crime? by unloading a company that was laced with toxic mortgages. There was no crime in that.
I don't think there's a crime in it because fraud is really hard to prove. You got to show that you intended to do, you know, that you intended to cause harm, and you know, fraud is really, really hard to prove.
But how would they have known? How did they know to sell out just before the collapse, though?
They're psychic. Who knows?
It's the question of like Dick Fuld and Lehman Brothers. Here he was. And he's portrayed in Too Big to Fail as some kind of victim who was screwed by everybody else. But Dick Fuld walked away with a lot of money. They estimate his fortune is near $1 billion, while Lehman Brothers is no more. It doesn't exist. One of America's great brokerage houses is gone. But Dick Fuld didn't get indicted or investigated. How is that possible?
It's really hard to say. They political favors and so on. I think what may have happened with the Sandlers is they reached a certain point in terms of profit, and they figured that, you know, it can't get any better than this, and we better cash out.
And then we can have a lot of fun destroying America through the ACLU, MoveOn.org,
Acorn,
and John Podesta's polluted mind. They can help destroy America with the pollution coming out of Podesta's American Progress Organization.
They're big funders of Center for American Progress. Absolutely. Yeah. So that you know, along with George Soros and the other members of the Democracy Alliance, that leftist billionaires club. Do you want to hear the other things that the Sandlers did in order to hurt Wells Fargo?
Sure.
They also, in 2003, Acorn published a report accusing two branches of Wells Fargo of predatory lending and other unethical business practices. In New Mexico, Acorn filed 14 complaints against the bank alleging unfair business practices. In 2004, Acorn did a class action lawsuit against the bank.
I want to pause and tell the listeners what you're saying. They may not be following you. You are stating that the Sandlers, who owned World Savings at the time, gave money to Acorn, then they used Acorn to go after their number one competitor, Wells Fargo.
Yes.
Okay.
This is what my sources have told me. They paid $11 million to Acorn and its affiliate groups.
Right.
And just miraculously, an incredible coincidence, Acorn went after Wells Fargo. On the date that the suit was filed, the class action suit I was referring to in 2004, against Wells Fargo, Acorn held a march and a rally in Los Angeles that involved more than 2,000 Acorn members. Okay, and Acorn National President, a woman named Maude Hurd, she's from Boston, Massachusetts, she gave a speech and said, "We will not allow Wells Fargo to continue to swindle and steal from our communities. We will fight until they stop their abusive loan practices and the Wells stagecoach is no longer delivering misery to homeowners." Then, in 2005, Acorn put out a sham study saying that...
I have to cut it off because you've got so much information, we can't squeeze it into 30 seconds or less. I've got to tell you, the book is fabulous, and I think people should look into the book, Subversion, Inc. Matthew, thank you very much for being with us on The Savage Nation. I wish you great luck with your book. It's an important one for people to read.
Thanks. Have me back to talk more about it because it's very...
Believe me, the market is not going to get better, and if it doesn't, we'll talk more about it. This is The Savage Nation. We're talking about greed and lies and the fact that virtually nobody who engineered the collapse has been indicted, investigated, or gone to jail. Think about it. Remember Enron? Remember how Barbara Baxter and the others screamed like bloody murder about the Enron scandal and how people lost their lives and lost their fortunes and went to prison? Ask yourself why Boxer is silent now.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Now listen up. Here's what's on michaelsavage.com. Egyptian general defends virginity checks on protesters. Well, it's the religion of peace. And therefore, they have to check on the virginity of young women, because in this country, we would call that perversion. But then what do we infidels know? Leave that to the clerics. Representative Alan West, my hero, says, I cannot understand the U.S. role in Libya. Neither can we. Rent a force in the region? Absolutely. Who are we fighting for? A Pakistani who exposed an Al-Qaeda cell? Found slain. Report, fewer died in Haiti earthquake than thought. In other words, they fudged the figures? Huh. Who would have thought? Sean Penn certainly believed it was greater than it was. Handcuffed by policy, fire crews in San Francisco watch a man die. They blame budget cuts for watching a man walk out into the bay of San Francisco and die. They watched him for an hour, saying that their budget cuts did not permit them to rescue the man. Take a look at some of the fire people. There's a woman that weighs at least 400 pounds with her hands in her trousers, with a fire suit on. That's Alameda County's fire department under the politically correct rules. Trial of Islam critic Geert Wilders nears end. Good for him. He warns about the dangers of radical Islam. Huh. Oh, by the way, he was banned from England. San Francisco sheriff to shield and release illegal alien criminals, speaking at the San Francisco Progressive Convention. They don't realize that all progress does not lead to good things. Some of it leads to bad things. Congress, well, let's not talk about them. Over 400 Al-Qaeda terrorists are now in the Sinai, planning to carry out terror attacks in Egypt. Well, why not? It's the Arab Spring. Spring forward into terrorism. I guess that's what they want to do, Beowulf. Spring forward with the Arab Spring?
Yeah, from lean forward to spring forward.
If you missed it, read Suicidal Britain Continues Absurd Ban of Michael Savage by the Dakota Voice. The letter Dr. Savage received last week reads like something out of the Soviet Union. Yes. Oh, here's another one for those of you who are confused. An Iran cleric, the radical religious Muslim cleric known as President Ahmadinejad's spiritual mentor, says killing Jewish children okay. It's a Muslim duty to commit suicide bombings. We do not know which liberals will go there and genuflect. U.S. military vets give Obama lower marks. Ku Klux Klan confronts Westboro Baptist Church. That's a tough one to figure out. Muslim girl 19 stoned to death after taking part in beauty contest. Three Muslim youths killed her. Wienergate explodes. Oconda merchant penalized. Little people, lots of pills. Experts debate medicating kids. 17 pills a day. But then, what the heck? The doctor says it's good. In the 30s, doctors smoked Chesterfield. Now they smoke something beyond Chesterfield. What's in the news today? Well, from michaelsavage.com to you, you heard it all. Here's some more. The Dow tumbled 280 points. Private sector jobs grew, well, by only 38,000 in May. Planned layoffs up, manufacturing slows, jobs being shipped overseas. We are on the verge of a great, great depression. Wienergate, he says it might be his wiener. TNA pays woman $2,350 to settle suit over breast exposure. Tornado watch in Kansas? No, New York City. Obama bailout of government motors to cost taxpayers at least $14 billion. What else is in the news? Well, go to Drudge Report as well. I mean, he's got the best stuff. Radiation from cell phones can cause cancer. Everything causes cancer. Hollywood execs caught on tape admitting liberal bias. I guess that's dog bites man. Greece goes further into junk territory. Moody's downgrades. Moody's. I'm real moody on Moody because they were part of the meltdown before. Palin goes to the Statue of Liberty and confirms that the tour will go national. How do you like that?
You bet.
Airline add-on fees double in 3 years to $21 billion. They're still losing money. Spain threatens to sue Germany over cucumber slur. Well, what else is really in the news? There's so much. It might be my wiener. That's an important one when you think about it. Here we have a standing congressman, or is he sitting, or is he exposing himself? We don't know. Wiener says it's possible the lewd photo is of himself. Rep. Anthony Wiener embroiled in a bizarre controversy over a lewd photo of a man's crotch sent to a young woman from his Twitter account. said today it's possible the photo is of him, though he insisted he didn't send it.
Really?
He called him a reporter a jackass the day before. On Wednesday, he reversed course and spoke to NBC's Luke Russert. He was expected to speak with CNN later in the day. He says, I was the victim of a prank. Wiener told NBC that he can't say with certitude whether the photo shows his body. Is this a big deal? Well, it is and it isn't. It's not a big deal, except that a Republican was forced to resign for exhibiting his chest, right? I mean, we know that he's a pugnacious left-wing fanatic hack. That we know. And in the middle of all of this about his wiener, you know what Wiener said? Wiener didn't talk about his wiener. He said, I don't want to talk about my wiener. I want to talk about the disparity between the rich and the poor in America. The rich and the poor. How about the dead and the naked, or the naked and the dead?
Give you a quote, okay? And here it is. The position is ridiculous, the relief momentary, and the cost abominable. Now, I'm not talking about talk radio. The position is ridiculous, the relief momentary, and the cost abominable. He was, of course, talking about relations between man and woman, I assume. And that was Lord Chesterfield, who lived several hundred years ago, born in 1694 and died in 1773. Quite a wit, British statesman, and very funny. I was quoting this all weekend with a few people that I ran into, and they really got a kick out of it. I don't know anyone who wouldn't laugh at that. The position is ridiculous, the relief momentary, and the cost abominable. Women especially get a kick out of that one. They look back on their husbands, and they get stuck. So I looked up Lord Chesterfield, and I was looking at some of his other quotes, and you say, hundreds of years ago, you know, what good is that now, right? Well, I'm going to read you some of them. I never do this. Are you ready for this? Let's see. An injury is much sooner forgotten than an insult. Hey. As fathers commonly go, it is seldom a misfortune to be fatherless, and considering the general run of sons, as seldom a misfortune to be childless. I think it's cute. Let's see. Distrust all those who love you extremely upon a very slight acquaintance and without any visible reason. That would be Madoff, right? Distrust all those who love you extremely upon a very slight acquaintance and without any visible reason. Remember the America? Oh, I love you, man. Remember the 60s? I love you. Remember all those politicians who would say, I love you, or the entertainers at the end of a show, I love you. Remember those? Let's see what else. Good humor is the health of the soul. Sadness is its poison. You know, for years of my life, mainly when I was a teenager, no, a late adolescent, early manhood thing, I used to read aphorisms of intelligent people. I thought that it would make me smarter. None of them worked. Absolutely none of them worked, by the way. Aphorisms don't work. The only thing that works is some money in your pocket. No, you quote Michael Savage on that one. A weak mind is like a microscope, which magnifies trifling things but cannot receive great ones. Does anyone read aphorisms anymore? The day is over. I see people walking around with their Blackberries, looking in their palm all the time. They're like morons. They're like idiots walking around. They're like bumblebees that have been sprayed with Raid. They walk down a street in bizarre, zigzaggy fashion, looking in their palm like it's the Holy Grail. This has to come to an end, this phase, don't you think? You think that the cell phone, the wireless device thing is going to come to an end where people are going to eschew them and start becoming humans again? You like sitting at dinner with someone who has a cell phone on the table? They put it down next to the napkin? I don't know about you, but I don't want to eat dinner. I tell them either shut it off or I'm leaving. You know, I don't really want to sit with someone they're texting underneath the table. I'm just bringing stuff up, that's all. Things that bother me. A novel must be exceptionally good to live as long as the average cat, Lord Chesterfield. None of these are as good as that one, though. The position is ridiculous, the relief momentary, and the cost abominable. That's his best. That's the only one he's remembered for. So I'm looking at your favorite, quote, authors, you know, like they're showing on this list of people who've said things that we should remember. Abraham Lincoln, Albert Einstein, Benjamin Franklin. Then they list in with him. The people they put in there like Maya Angelou, you hear? You never heard of Maya Angelou? What is she doing in there? I don't understand this. They put people I never heard of in there. Where's Michael Savage? Liberalism is a mental disorder. That's a quote that should live through the ages. But since the liberals control all of these sites, you won't see it anywhere. You know what I mean? Mark Twain is in the same category as her. Mark Twain they put in the same list as Maya Angelou, Obama's favorite nun poet. Unbelievable to me. Yogi Berra, they put in the same list with William Shakespeare. Unbelievable the kind of idiocy that passes for intelligence today. I'll be right back. It's the Savage Nation.
Savage.
I want to go back to something that I put together for you months back, and I don't remember when, but it was called Obama and the Shadow Socialist Group Behind Egypt's Fall by Michael Savage. Barack Obama, I said, has been playing a critical role in making sure that Egypt, one of our staunchest allies in the Middle East, is positioned to become the next member of the Union of Iranian Radical Islamist Republics headed by Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. Every single word out of the president's mouth, every single move he's made has had the effect of stabbing Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak in the back, of opening the door to Islamist radicals taking another step on their way to restoring an unholy caliphate in that region. Now, I wrote this several months ago before Mubarak was thrown out, before the Muslim Brotherhood achieved the presence that it has, before the Christians were killed, before the churches were burned. I'll continue what I wrote. The historical precedent for Obama's actions can be found in those of another weak liberal Democratic president, Jimmy Carter. In the late 1970s, I wrote, the Shah of Iran ruled that country in much the same way Hosni Mubarak has ruled Egypt, through maintaining tight control over the population with a strong military and the support of the United States. When Carter withdrew his support of the Shah in the name of, quote, human rights, he enabled the Ayatollah Khomeini to return to Iran from his exile in Paris and assume leadership of the country. It looks very much like Obama is following directly in Carter's footsteps. The problem is that the situation is much more serious today than it was 30 years ago. Blame that on Jimmy Carter. Carter's turning over Iran to the mullahs has allowed Islamist radicalism to establish a soon-to-be nuclear outpost in the region. Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is set to expand his influence and power by abetting the overthrow of nations such as Egypt that retain ties with and receive support from the West. There is no doubt that Ahmadinejad sees himself as the leader of an Islamist union that wields power, that wields immense power, okay, over the entire Middle East and threatens Western civilization as well. Since the 9/11 attacks on the United States, the left in America has come out on the side of Islamist radicals. They cheered as the Twin Towers fell and American lives were lost. With the election of one of their own as president of the United States, the left moved even closer to realizing its aim of bringing down our country. It is not out of the question that Barack Obama is actually working to ensure that our allies in the Middle East, including Egypt and Jordan, follow in the footsteps of Iran in installing a radical Islamist government. It is not out of the question that Obama seeks the demise of our staunchest ally, Israel. I wrote this several months ago. What is becoming clear is that, like Jimmy Carter, Obama is on the side of Islamist radicals. When Iranian students stage an uprising after the rigged election in that country, ensured that the totalitarian government of Ahmadinejad would remain in power, Obama was on vacation in Hawaii and threatened the Iranian insurrection and treated the Iranian insurrection as nothing more than a nuisance. Instead of intervening and speaking out strongly in favor of the students and the overthrow of a truly heinous enemy regime, Obama declined to take sides, saying, it's up to Iranians to decide who Iran's leaders will be. By not speaking out and taking the lead in denouncing the Iranian regime, Obama revealed where his sympathies lay. Only a few weeks earlier, Obama had delivered one of his more insipid speeches. Speaking in Cairo, he had called for America to end torture and close the prison at Guantanamo Bay in order to reclaim its, quote, moral authority. Obama's insistence that the people of Iran should decide who their leaders are simply ignored the fact that the Ahmadinejad regime had rigged the election. The point was that there was no way the Iranian people could decide who the leaders would be. By saying what he did, Obama came down solidly on the side of the Muslim dictatorship and rigging elections in order to achieve it. Less than 2 years later, the Cairo insurrection against one of America's staunchest allies, Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak, provided Obama with another chance to speak out against Islamist radicalism. Instead, he's again waffled and backtracked and stabbed Mubarak in the back by demanding that the Egyptian president step down immediately. Incidentally, he's out already. Nobody is saying that Mubarak's government is a paragon of democratic rule. What Mubarak has done, though, is to provide a stabilizing influence in the Middle East. He's the closest thing to a friend that Israel has in the region. He's helped Israel secure its borders, and he's kept the terrorist Muslim Brotherhood from gaining power in Egypt by outlawing them. Let me pause. That's yesterday. Today it's over. It's over now. So where did all of this come from? Let me speed up to the next point in my article, and I will show you that the handwriting was on the wall, and it comes all the way from George Soros all over again. It's the very man who engineered the financial meltdown of our country, who enabled Obama to get elected in the first place. Once again, the fingerprints of George Soros are all over this. You know, night falls over all of us, and then life itself falls at the end. Today, I woke up and I said, "Why? Where is it written I have to save Western civilization? Where is it written that I have to get up every day and carry this world on my shoulders?" So I went and got my birth certificate. It has my name, where I was born or when I was born. It has my mother's name and my father's name. But it doesn't say, "Michael, you shall save Western civilization. You shall be required unto the to scream your heart out as you watch the world going up in flames with quislings at every level of the U.S. government." You don't have to do that. What the heck are you doing it for? Just play rock and roll and do a two-dimensional radio show. You'll make more money like the rest of them. Republicans, good. Republicans going to save America. It's those dams that are no good. You got to vote for Republicans. Don't vote for them dams. No good. Maybe we've all gotten dumber together under Obama. It's possible that Obama's lowered the native intelligence of the American people by around 15 points since he seized power and he took control of the media.
Savage.
Republican Congressman Steve King is a really great guy, a real conservative. He's Iowa's 5th District Representative, and he's on the Savage Nation today to tell you what he thinks about the 2012 GOP field. Congressman King, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Well, thanks a lot for having me on, Michael. It's good to be back with you today.
What do you think of the declared GOP presidential field so far?
Well, you know, I like all of the people that are there, and so often I hear criticism, a little rumbling around the public. They don't think there's a Ronald Reagan in the list, and I'm not sure that we knew Ronald Reagan was in the list when he was in the list. So, you know, it's presidents are sometimes made, not born, and they're made by the challenge of the times. But when I look at the list of people that are there that are, I'll say, somewhat declared or have declared their intentions to make an announcement, they are good people. They're solid people. And I think the list is going to get longer instead of shorter in the upcoming 2 or 3 weeks.
Well, what about those who we all know are running for the GOP nomination but haven't actually declared?
Well, of course, they are good people. And, you know, Sarah Palin lit up the political world when she was named as running mate to John McCain. I think that she impressed people with her ability. She had charisma. She could fill the room no matter how big the room she filled it. And I remember feeling the electrifying nature of Sarah Palin when she walked in. And, you know, remember, John McCain was at risk of being eclipsed by his designated vice presidential nominee. So let's not forget that part, even though Sarah Palin's negative numbers have gone up since then. And Chris Christie, a lot of people believe that he has made a presidential timber. He's made it real clear he doesn't intend to run for president. We know people change their minds. I want to see that people that are going to be candidates and jump in this race with both feet, and let's get into the debates, let's build organization, let's debate the national agenda, and let's see if we can hammer out a destiny for America that the American people can get behind and beat Barack Obama. So I just challenge them all, let's engage in Iowa, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and beyond. It's getting time, and America needs a new leader. The one we have now is wearing down our Constitution and our budget in the spirit of the American people.
Well, which issue do you think will be the most important to Republicans in 2012?
Well, you know, as I look at this, at first we know that the Democrats, and Michael, have taken over the field here in the last few weeks since the Ryan budget, and they would like to make the single subject of the 2012 election Medicare. And, you know, what are Republicans going to talk about? Well, I think they need to turn around and go on offense. The president's Obamacare cuts Medicare by $532 billion. That's half a trillion dollars that they take out of Medicare. And so they change Medicare as we know it. We're trying to save it. That'll be part of the dialogue that's going on. Another piece of this discussion must be the full and complete 100% repeal of Obamacare. If there's a presidential candidate out there that seeks to run against Obama and not run against Obamacare, I would be surprised, and I'd like to hear what their argument is. And, you know, occasionally I'll run across some Republicans that want to preserve a part of it to avoid controversy, and I say, You have to pull it all out by the roots, 100% of it. So there's the two big pieces, and then debt and deficit and jobs in the economy. But as we're looking at it right now, the debt ceiling, that's something that will be resolved, I think, to at least a temporary degree, sometime late this summer or maybe early in the fall. And how that gets resolved and the leverage that's used will change the direction of the presidential debate. But also remember that last December, Democrats and Republicans approved an extension of the Bush tax brackets. That expires at the end of 2012, and that'll be expiring in the face of a presidential election in November 2012. So that'll be up front and center as a debate. Where do we go with taxes? And, of course, most people that know me know I want to eliminate the IRS and go to a national sales tax. I'm trying to remember who wrote the article, but an observation of this, that if you look at the social democracies in Western Europe, they've almost always voted for more largesse for themselves and greater debt and a greater deficit. But in America, the American people went to the polls, and they voted Nancy Pelosi's majority out of the House of Representatives in a dramatic change. And they changed a lot of seats in the United States Senate, not enough. And that's because Americans said to the, they said in the polls to the members of Congress that they elected, we want less government, not more. We want more personal responsibility. We want less taxes. We want less spending. We want government to do less in our lives. That was a resounding message from November of 2010, and I think the American people are now likely to change their mind, especially given this non-recovery recovery economically and the growth of debt deficit. The president would like to get this debt ceiling off the table so he's not dealing with it going into the election in 2012. It's his baby. This albatross of the debt ceiling is tied around President Obama's neck.
Are there really going to be spending cuts attached to the debt ceiling vote?
Oh, I think we will. The vote that we just had that came in with 97 Democrats voting for this clean debt ceiling increase and 318 of us all together voting against it, says clearly the president is not going to get what he asked for with his debt ceiling increase of $2.4 trillion. And so I think the president's worried. I just came from a meeting with him within the last few hours. And I think the president's worried about what's going to happen with the negotiation of the debt ceiling. This time, the Republicans in the House hold the cards. And how those cards are played will have a lot to do with how much debt gets laid on the heads of every baby born into America. It's roughly someplace over $44,000 right now. Was for my little granddaughter, Reagan Ann King, when she came into the world. Now the number's gone up. That's got to go down if there's going to be a future for the American children.
The liberal media is pushing the narrative that Obama is unbeatable in 2012. I don't think that's true. Do you?
Yeah, I believe President Obama is beatable in 2012. The one wave that he's riding is what the SEALs did to take out Osama bin Laden. And, you know, I've heard some of his people on his side, his administration, say it's the most courageous decision they'd ever seen a president of the United States make. It surely didn't strike me that way. I mean, it was a good decision, and I'm glad that he made it. But truthfully, if it had been wrong, then, you know, we would have never heard about a failed operation unless the casualties had been so high for our side that they would have had to report it. It was a clandestine maneuver that would not have been reported to the American people unless it were successful. But I'm glad he did it. He's riding that wave. Remember George Herbert Walker Bush, riding the wave of Desert Storm. He had the super high approval ratings, and a year and a half later, he was turned out of office by the American people. This recovery is not taking place. It is very, very flat. The private sector only generated something like 38,000 jobs in the last cycle. And the growth in federal spending and federal employment has gone up. This president is a Keynesian economist on steroids. He does not understand, nor does he appreciate, nor believe in the private sector and the free markets that have driven the economy in this country. And a president who doesn't understand it or believe in it cannot engineer a recovery. FDR did not engineer a recovery during the Great Depression. Barack Obama believes that FDR didn't borrow enough, didn't spend enough. This president will not back off, and if we go through another year and a half with no recovery, people will forget about Osama bin Laden. They won't be giving him a pass on that, just like they didn't give George Herbert Walker Bush a pass on the great success of Desert Storm.
Well, it looks to me like the media is choosing the Republican candidate instead of the voters. What do you think?
You know, I believe a lot in the system that we have, and I've traveled into the states of course, Iowa. I'm one of the few people in Congress that can go to Iowa and not start a rumor that I'm running for president. But also New Hampshire, South Carolina, and a lot of the states around the country. I see the media that flows through. I wouldn't say that the media is choosing a candidate. They do initiate the dialogue. But you have people in the early states that take this job very seriously. They will make it a point to go out and meet all the candidates. They'll talk to them. They'll probe them. Some will meet every one of them one-on-one in private. That measure of their public performance and their public persona and their private persona gets fed through the grapevine, and we're far more effective with this Facebook, Twitter, email grapevine than we were when we were doing it by telephone or by Pony Express. We have an instantaneous social media out there now that connects the supporters with each other, and I think in the end they're going to be having more to say about this in the media. And remember, Howard Dean was the chosen nominee of the media for the nomination in 2004 for the Democrats. We knew he wasn't going to be the nominee 2 or 3 weeks out of the Iowa caucus because we could see that even Democrats, as much as they liked what he said, couldn't really settle themselves with the idea of Howard Dean as president. So the American people will decide, but the media will have a voice.
Have you ever thought about making a run for the presidency?
Well, I think everybody that's run for town mayor on up the line has thought about it one time or another. The question comes up to me, not as much in the last month, but in the previous 4, 5, 6 months, it was coming continually several times a week from people that were well-positioned. I tell people the same answer each time. I'm short two things. The first one is a groundswell, and the next one is a calling. And, of course, if you have a calling, you don't really need the groundswell. You believe that will come. But I just want to serve my country the best capacity that I can. And at this point, I'm looking for a candidate that is a full-spectrum conservative, one that I can get behind and believe in and be enthusiastic about, that I can go out and actively support. There are a number of them on the list that I think, you know, I can meet that criteria. And like I say, I think that list is probably not going to get shorter in the short term. It's probably going to get longer by a name or two, and then it'll start to narrow.
Congressman Steve King, thanks for being with us on the Savage Nation.
Well, Michael, thank you very much. I appreciate you having me back on. If people like to follow what I'm doing, they can just take a look at steveking.com, and on there is that is my website, or just Google Steve King, and I usually will pop up as the first hit. And then on there are my Twitter and my Facebook accounts, and we try to stay in communication and appreciate everybody that's out there paying attention to these important issues that we're all engaged in.
This is the Savage Nation. I'll be back.
Savage.
I had a dream early in the dawn hours, close to dawn rather, that my silent brother, my deceased brother Jerome, who never spoke a word, never walked a step, I don't think he ever saw anything either. My silent brother was accused falsely by someone of committing a crime. And it was a white male accusing him of this crime or these crimes, and he was sneering as he was doing it. He said, "Your brother did this, your brother did that." And I said, "Wait a minute, he couldn't have done that. He was in a wheelchair. He couldn't speak. He couldn't walk. He couldn't do anything." And the guy continued to sneer at my brother, my silent brother, and said, "No, he committed this crime. He committed that crime." And I said to him, "You're a liar, and I'm going to prove it. And when I'm through proving it, I'm going to slay you." And I woke up in a start at dawn. And then I realized something. I realized why I fight. I fight for those who can't speak. I fight for those who may have a voice but who are silenced by our society. I fight for myself. Do you understand that I am you and you are me and we are all one together, to use the old Beatles song? Take it for what it is. Laugh at it if you want. I know there's a lot of cynicism out there. I understand that. I understand it's very hard to distinguish between what a guy is telling you is truth and what is made up. But the fact of the matter is, I've been tried, convicted, and punished without a trial in the land that gave us the Magna Carta. This is right out of Orwell. And all liberals grew up reading George Orwell. But now that they're facing George Orwell, it doesn't matter, because it's not one of theirs who received the bad news. Then I had another thought. I was laying in bed from about 4:30 in the morning, trying to think about getting up for the day and what I wanted to do on the radio today. And my mind was spinning. Darwin called it spinning headedness. Today they call it a medical condition when you can't control your thoughts and they put you on medication. I got up and did push-ups. It always works. There's no need for medication from spinning headedness. It's called a bright mind that has many thoughts. But many of you are afraid of a mind that starts to work. That's how your mind starts. It's how an engine gets turned over. Don't you understand this? It's not an illness. Your mind is turning over. It's like starting an engine. So what you do is you stop the engine from turning over, and you start the engine, and you start to think. You get up and do push-ups and focus on which one of those thoughts you want to work on. Remember what Henry Miller wrote? Each morning I wake up and a thousand paths open before me. You can go in many directions any day. You have to decide where you want to go. It doesn't mean you're crazy because you have a million thoughts. I learned this 40 years ago. It doesn't mean you're nuts because you have many ideas and many thoughts. It means you're pretty smart. You choose which road you want to go down. No one's controlling you, you know? So then I'm laying there, the mind spinning, and I'm trying to focus on something to calm me down, and I can't focus. And all of a sudden, the words Jesus of Nazareth come in my mind. And I don't want to turn this into a religious show. And I said to myself, you know, Jesus of Nazareth is a philosophically important concept. Let's put aside the religious connotations of the word Jesus. But Jesus of Nazareth is an idea, the same way all prophets are ideas. Do you understand what I'm saying to you? Now, I understand hundreds of millions of people on the planet have peace through their religion, the religion of Christianity. When they think of Jesus as their personal savior, they become calm. They can face anything. They can walk through a storm. They can take a hail of bullets, and they have the strength that they need. But when I say to you, Jesus of Nazareth entered my mind without my reaching out to find that concept, I'm telling you something else. I'm telling you that there is calm in the middle of the world, and I know that there's the hand of God in all of this. Hawaii, thank you for calling, Bill. Welcome to the program. What's on your mind, Hawaii, Bill?
Hi, Dr. Savage, long-time listener. And I just want to ask you about your process of writing. You know, is it a couple pages a day, or do you do a whole bunch at once, or you know, how do you
know, it's very interesting. It's very interesting. I find that when I'm on a bicycle sometimes in the morning, I get up, small breakfast, take a lot of vitamin C powder. If I take a bike ride, usually within about 5 minutes of the bike ride, a thought will pop into my head that will become a seed for an entire concept. And then I go back and I can dictate that thought, which can become part of a chapter, for example. But, you know, writing is interesting. There are a lot of people who can write, but they have no ideas. Writing should be based upon ideas rather than just upon words. And I believe that my books have good ideas in them, which is why they've attracted an audience. But to answer your question specifically, I don't have a set schedule in that regard. I don't have that kind of discipline where I get up at 4 in the morning and write till 6. I think that's what you were asking, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean,
I think everybody has to find their own inspiration. And what kind of book are you interested in, or what are you trying to write, an article or a book?
Well, I've written a novel, a bunch of short stories, and a couple of screenplays.
Oh.
And
you just want to know what a fellow author does to motivate himself, is that it?
Yeah, I mean, because I have a, you know, basically come up with an idea is the toughest part. Having the idea is the rough part. And then you just got to hammer it out, you know. Sometimes just a couple pages is all you can get out of yourself per day.
Yeah, but, you know, don't you find in the writing world that there are many, many very skilled craftsmen who can write a good screenplay, but they have nothing original, no original ideas? I mean, that's what I find. If you look at movies, like there's a movie out now that I'm not going to go to. It's the one about Hangover Part 2. I like the first movie. But when I saw that an interview with the writers for that movie who said, Will, we smoke a lot of pot, and then we come up with the craziest ideas we can, such as a midget spits out a dog who spits out a joint, and we just keep smoking joints. I said, you know what? I'm never going to go to their movies. I don't need to listen to the deranged insanity of a stupid pothead in Hollywood. You follow what I'm saying? That's not my idea of creativity. You just come up with stupid ideas. And unfortunately, that's what passes for creativity today. The more bizarre, the more outlandish, the more pornographic, you mean it's creative? Only when you have a debased society that it's out of ideas can Hollywood survive. Those are not ideas. There's nothing ennobling about these movies. When I was a kid, I went to the movies. Not every movie was inspirational, but some were. I would see a movie about, for example, a war hero, To Hell and Back, about Audie Murphy. I'd come out of the movie loving America, for example.
or John Wayne. I come out loving justice and truth and the little guy standing up to the greatest odds. I came out inspired to fight for what I believed in. I can give you many examples. Movies about Madame Curie, a woman way ahead of her time, 100 years ahead of her time. She didn't need the EEOC and the women's movement and loudmouths like the people in the women's movement to help her get where she got. How'd she get there? Because she was a straight-out genius. Those were the movies that inspired me. But they were movies that had principle to them and meaning, and they were also entertaining. I'll tell you another one, Jim Thorpe, All American. I don't know if anyone ever remembers that. It was about an American Indian in a boy's home. But he was such a great athlete, how he overcame prejudice against Native Americans to become one of the great athletes of his time. Now you say, well, how could you relate to that being a kid from the Bronx? Because I relate to a lot of things. I always have. I wasn't one of these bellhops from Brooklyn who was limited in what I could see and what I could think. That's how the bellhops from Brooklyn wound up hating America so much. Their distemper toward Christianity in America is pathological, incidentally.
Savage.